Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White, and we have a show full of very meaty segments today with deep dives into history and current events. So stick with us for the full hour, and I can guarantee you're going to walk away with a better grasp of our world and your surrounding communities. And that includes one of the largest Armenian communities in the world, which is right here in California. Currently, their homeland is at war, and some say continued genocide is imminent. We'll have two experts joining us who can help us understand what's unfolding. Also, Cap Radio Reads host Donna Abedoni will discuss the book Driving While Black, and we'll put that subject matter through the California lens with a professor of African American studies at UC Davis. But first up, for Californians, tonight may be the most anticipated debate of the 2020 race for the White House, as Senator Kamala Harris and incumbent Mike Pence take the stage for the first and only vice presidential debate. Ken Rudin, you know him, he's host of the Political Junkie podcast, and he joins us now to walk us through what we can expect to hear out of Salt Lake City starting at 6 o'clock, right here on Cap Radio and on our website at capradio.org, where you can watch a live stream too. Ken, always great to have you back.
Thank you, Randall. Good morning.
So, vice presidential debates, they aren't generally at the forefront in comparison to the presidential debates. These candidates only face off one time, and then it's up to the presidential debates, of course, to sway voters in the following two debates. But how is this one now different from previous debates?
Well, it is different. You know, I always say that it really doesn't matter. Vice presidential debates don't matter. And I always point to, for example, you know, when Dan Quayle and Lloyd Benson got into it in 1988 and the famous "You're no Jack Kennedy," and everybody thought Dan Quayle looked so terrible and foolish. And yet the Bush-Quayle ticket won 40 out of 50 states. So ultimately, there could be some great moments in vice presidential history. Admiral Stockdale, who am I? What am I doing here? You know, those right. kind of things. But having said that, we have a 74-year-old president who has COVID, the COVID virus, and we have the Democratic candidate for president will turn 78 next year. I mean, next month. So therefore, we may be looking with Mike Pence and Kamala Harris, we may be looking at somebody who may very well be the next president of the United States. It sounds unfortunate to say, but it's a realistic expectation. Certainly it's something to talk about. So I think this one has more significance than most.
Both of the candidates, the vice presidential candidates, have tested negative for COVID in recent days. In addition to testing before the debates, there will also be a plexiglass barrier in front of the candidates. The Trump administration was resistant to this, but finally agreed to it. What other changes do you foresee in this debate?
Well, I mean, the plexiglass thing is a big difference. And of course, it goes against the grain of what the Trump campaign is trying to say, that the virus is a lot like the flu. I mean, here we have the president of the United States who, after downplaying the virus for 6 or 7 months and then gets it himself, when he comes home from Walter Reed Hospital, he takes off his mask and says, "You don't have anything to fear. Don't be afraid of COVID. Don't let it dominate your life." Tell that to 214,000 Americans who have died. But one thing that will certainly be different in tonight's debate than was from the food fight we saw between Trump and Biden last week is that Mike Pence is a very interesting debater. He can be cutting, he can be critical, he can be sarcastic, but he's very smooth. I mean, he's a former radio talk show host. He's very controlled. He's underrated and understated. He won't have the bombast of Donald Trump, but he could also make his points very well made. And that's what he did, I think, 4 years ago against Tim Kaine. I think he won the debate against Tim Kaine. One, Tim Kaine interrupted constantly, and Mike Pence was very cool and collected. So I expect that again tonight. But he also has to defend an administration who, I said, you know, oversaw 214,000 Americans who died from the virus, 7 million Americans who've been infected. That's a tall order. At the same time, Kamala Harris, I mean, we forget about this. This is the first Now, she's not only a woman, she's a black woman on a ticket. This is history in the making. And that could be jarring to some people. I mean, she had a mixed reaction, a mixed scorecard when she debated in her bid for the presidency. She was very tough against Joe Biden, but then she let Tulsi Gabbard and others get under her skin with criticism. So, and she was very tough during the confirmation hearings with Brett Kavanaugh and William Barr and Jeff Sessions. So you don't really know which Kamala Harris you're going to get tonight. But certainly, look, this could be the last debate of the year. We don't know if they can even let President Trump debate again, depending on his health and his test results. So this could be the last chance for both sides to make the case for their respective running mates.
I've seen Twitter chatter ever since Kamala Harris was announced as the running mate, with people anxious to see this vice presidential debate. Sometimes when you're built up like that, it can play to your disadvantage, right?
That's absolutely true. Be careful what you wish for, especially, as they said, against somebody like Mike Pence, who is very cool and collected and on message. He won't have the passion of Donald Trump, but he is very, very effective. And again, Kamala Harris has to know that while there is so much in the Trump record to go after, you also have a president who is sick, at this moment. And there are some people who say, well, it may be untoward if you go after the president personally. So she has a fine line to walk.
How much does the president erase that, though, by the comments he's made since being released from the hospital?
Well, see, that's the thing. I mean, yes, Joe Biden took down all his negative commercials. And of course, Trump refused to do that. But all the criticism that everybody's had about Trump, about the handling of the virus or the mishandling of the virus, that has not gone away, especially one when he did that little joyride in the SUV while he's still in the hospital, so he could wave to his supporters. And goodness knows what effect or how he may have affected Secret Service personnel in that SUV, that tightly closed SUV, put them at risk. And then he comes to the White House, gets home, takes off his mask, and says it's nothing more than the flu. Well, we're back to, you think that maybe, well, I went through this horror of the virus. I know what it's like. I had this new empathy. We did not hear that. I think he could have made a case for himself had he done that, but that is not Donald Trump. Once again, it's no more than the flu. Don't let it interrupt your life.
Following the presidential debate, Ken, there was talk of, and I believe changes put into place for any potential future presidential debates. Do those new rules apply to the vice presidential debate as well, in terms of being able to cut a mic and that sort of thing?
As far as I know, it doesn't. As far as I know, those were still recommendations that have not been ironed out by the two sides yet. I know that the interruptions made by Trump last week were so egregious that the Commission on Presidential Debates were going to change the rules. But first of all, I don't think you have anything to worry about, because these are not interrupting candidates, certainly not Mike Pence. But in the, it's interesting, the plexiglass thing is new. Barrier. And of course the Trump campaign was dismissing it. There was a Trump aide who said that, well, if Kamala Harris really needs it, bully for her. And she was dismissing it. And this is the same woman whose husband is Stephen Miller, who has COVID. So who tested positive for COVID. So it's almost seems like it's still an ideological purity thing, that you have to just say that it's not a big deal. You don't need to wear masks. And one thing that has changed, last time the rules were, if you're sitting in the audience without a mask, you can't do that. And yet the entire Trump family sat there without a mask. This time they say that if there's anybody in the audience without a mask, they will be ejected from the room. That'll be interesting to see if that is carried out.
Ken, let's go down some of the potential points of attack for each candidate. For Vice President Pence, I assume he will go after Harris and try to paint her as far to the left as possible.
He's done that, and the Republicans have done that from the moment she was named. And matter of fact, they're doing it with Joe Biden as well, a radical left positions. And of course, if anybody is not radical left, it's Joe Biden. But is Kamala Harris further to the left? Yes. And she did have a slip in an interview a couple bunch of weeks ago where she said, in my administration, she meant the Biden-Harris administration, but the Republicans didn't let that slip. Basically, they're going to paint this administration, this ticket, which Republicans do have done in the past, far left, far to the left of the American people. They're going to be pro-Antifa and against law and order. And you'll see that. And of course, you know, I've seen some horrific things from Republicans on social media and in photos around the country. Joe and Ho on signs around the country from Republican officials thinking that's funny or clever. It's the sexism and the misogyny and the racism hasn't gone away with Kamala Harris. And it'll be very interesting to see if there will be any dog whistles in tonight's thing.
How often do you expect the vice president to attach Senator Harris to California?
Well, that's a good question. I didn't even think of that. I mean, look, a lot of California has had better days, shall we say. But you could also make the case that the president's understanding or lack of understanding of what's happening with the fires is so remarkably apparent that maybe that's a strong case in her favor. I think really what he'll do, though, is just talk about her voting record in the Senate, talk about how she's, you know, radical left, and she'll point to he'll point to the disruption, the disorder in the country in Kenosha and elsewhere. Whereas, you know, I don't think she has to talk about Black Lives Matter, but all she has to do is say that what the police have done, what the Black community has responded to in the wake of systemic racism, that's something that is in her favor, and I think she could be very passionate about that.
Yeah, so let's flip the playbook as you were starting to do there. Harris, on her attack of the vice president, what might she point out?
Well, let's remember, I mean, Mike Pence is the head of the coronavirus task force. Now, if you want to put that on your resume, you know, God bless. But the fact is, as we've talked about all the people who have died and have been sick, you know, it's one thing to say for the president, well, I got the best care in the world. He has at Walter Reed in the White House. He has 24-hour care. That's not what many hundreds of thousands of others are facing as well. But to say that, you know, I think what's smart about what she'll do is just like what Mike Pence did 4 years ago. He didn't really run against Tim Kaine as much as he attacked Hillary Clinton. I don't think Kamala Harris is going to spend much time with Mike Pence. The whole thing isn't about Trump and the economy and the neglect and the ignoring the significance of the coronavirus and their record on it. And I don't know how you could defend that. I don't know how they could defend it.
Do you see much of a difference between the debates that Senator Harris was part of leading up to this, where there was a stage full of people, and so the amount of time that you got to make your point was short, and you really had to get whatever messaging you needed out there, versus a one-on-one that she'll be having tonight and her ability as a prosecutor to take down someone?
Well, of course, there's a difference in what we saw with her and the 240 other Democrats who ran for president. But let's not forget that when she ran for district attorney of San Francisco, against Terrence Hallahan, she had a one-on-one debate. When she ran for attorney general of California in 2010, she had a one-on-one debate, was very effective, had very good zingers and good responses. They weren't it wasn't about arguing and being prosecutorial, but she was very measured and listened very carefully. And when the time was right, she came out with very strong talking points that seemed to win over the debate. So she's had this in the past in her career, not recently, but again, Mike Pence hasn't had a debate in 4 years either. So the two of them may be a little rusty. You may see a little nervousness in the beginning.
Ken, you'll be back here tomorrow morning to talk about what we saw and heard. And I imagine it'll be a much different conversation than we had a week ago following the presidential debate. But I look
yes, but
to
you
it.
and I will have a plexiglass between us, so to make it, you know, just to make it safe.
We have about 3,000 miles between us, which
oh, there is that too.
Makes, yeah.
I forgot about that part.
Ken Rudin is the host of the Political Junkie podcast, and always welcome here on Cap Radio's Insight. Ken, thank you so much. I look forward to talking to you tomorrow.
Randall, thank you. Have a great debate.
Up next, Armenia at war. Why it matters globally, locally, and why Armenians around the world and here in California are fighting for your attention on this. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White, and we are back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You are listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. On Monday, an estimated 1,000 Sacramento Armenian Americans took to Capitol Mall to protest and call attention to the war happening in their homeland of Armenia. In Los Angeles, tens of thousands have taken to the streets demanding news outlets like CNN and the LA Times cover what's going on half a world away. Here's what's happened. Back on September 27th, Azerbaijan launched a military offensive against a small territory called Nagorno-Karabakh. This area is ethnically Armenian, but it's actually landlocked in the country of Azerbaijan. Armenia is Christian. Azerbaijan is predominantly Islamic. The area has a long history of being fought over, and it's happening right now with casualties. And if it's not dealt with by the international community, it has the potential to turn into a major regional conflict with lots of players. To help us explain the history of the region and why war has broken out time and time again, we welcome Professor Keith David Wattenpaugh. He's the director of human rights studies at UC Davis and an expert on genocide and its denial and the role of the refugee and displaced peoples in world history. Professor Wattenpaugh, it is great to have you back on Insight. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Randall, and thank you. I mean, this is a significant show. It's hard to follow the great Ken Rudin, but I'll do my best. And Alex is an incredible spokesman for the Armenian people in California. And you're also hosting my favorite colleague, or amongst my most favorite colleagues, Milman Harrison, later today.
Right. Yeah. The lineup of the rest of the hour to come there. And Professor Wattenpaugh, in terms of how I just laid it out there, did that sound about right to you?
That sounds about right. I mean, this is one of those extremely complex problems that's been left to fester for over 30 years now. I think, yeah, one of the challenges we have as we wake up this morning is, why should the people of California, you know, care about a war happening half a world away in the South Caucasus? And I think, to use a California analogy, this is a wildfire that has 0% containment. Mm. And we know what happens to those kinds of wildfires and how destructive they can possibly be. But I think what we're also seeing is the results of what happens when the United States steps away from the world stage, where there's disarray and a lack of leadership at the top, that not only is peace threatened, but in the case of the war that's emerging between Armenia, Nagorno-Karabakh on one side, Azerbaijan, and our NATO ally, Turkey, on the other, is that democracy, human rights are threatened, and we're already seeing the massive displacement of people from the Nagorno-Karabakh Republic seeking to flee incessant shelling, attacks from the air, and the destruction of critical infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So it's a wildfire, and we need to pay attention to it to try to do our best to bring it under control.
Professor, to give people sort of a mental image of how this is playing out, if Reno, Nevada, were filled with Californians, and some in Reno might say that's already the case, but let's say that Reno is like an enclave of California, but the only way to get to Reno is from California is to drive through a portion of Nevada, which is, you know, the way it is sure. right now along the 80 corridor. That's sort of the setup we have here, right? With California being Armenia and Nevada being Azerbaijan and this little enclave of Reno being Nagorno-Karabakh.
That's an interesting analogy. Let me paint another picture slightly. So Nagorno-Karabakh is about the size of Humboldt County with about the same population, 150,000 people. Mm. And the indigenous inhabitants of that region are Armenians. During the era of the establishment of the Soviet Union, Joseph Stalin, the great strongman and dictator of the Soviet Union, wanted to break up ethnic communities, especially in the South Caucasus region, the area north of Iran and south of Russia and bordered by the Caspian Sea and Turkey. And so on purpose, this enclave of Armenians was placed in a sea of Azeri, to try to undermine the unity of the various smaller states of the Soviet Union in that region. And so our Nagorno-Karabakh, when it declared its independence at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union, also declared its independence from Azerbaijan, which it had been put into for political reasons, and sought to join Armenia. And Azerbaijan rejected that, and a war ensued. And this again is in the era of the breakup of the Soviet Union, many states were breaking away, and the international community saw this as a danger to international stability. They didn't want states declaring independence. In this case, it caused one of the worst wars in the era of the breakup of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s. Terrible massacres, ethnic cleansing, and ultimately the pushing out of all Muslims and all Azeris from what became Nagorno-Karabakh and the destruction of the Armenian communities of Azerbaijan, including in Baku, which had been a real center of Armenian culture and arts and society.
And so what's happening there now? Azerbaijan has decided that they want to have some control over a portion of this area?
That's a very important question. Azerbaijan has never accepted Nagorno-Karabakh's independence. And in the war that followed in the early 1990s, both Armenia and Nagorno-Karabakh seized more territory than Karabakh itself. And so right now, what we think is happening is that Azerbaijan is seeking to create new facts on the ground to try to conquer or reconquer Nagorno-Karabakh. And I think I want to pause here for a second and paint a picture of what's different between Armenia and Nagorno-Karabakh and Azerbaijan and Turkey. Armenia is a state that, while it's gone through some difficult times, as Nagorno-Karabakh, has really established itself as one of the only true democracies and human rights observing states in the South Caucasus. Hmm. Azerbaijan is an authoritarian state ruled by a man who inherited the job from his father. And in all the human rights indices that we follow, like Freedom House and Human Rights Watch and so on, it ranks at the bottom. And right now, Turkey is dominated by a populist Islamist demagogue, Erdogan, who is using this war and his support for Azerbaijan to play to his public. And Turkey, like Azerbaijan, has a miserable human rights record. And one of its most noteworthy problems is that it has imprisoned more journalists, right, your brothers and sisters, Randall, than any other country on the planet. So this is one of the things that's at stake in this war, and why we should be concerned, is this is a war between democratic human rights observing two states, Armenia and Nagorno-Karabakh, and two states that wish to are authoritarian, and our intent, at least this is the public rhetoric, on the destruction of Nagorno-Karabakh as an independent enclave.
And Professor Wattenpaw, that's where it really starts to get complicated, right? If you look at the rest of the world players and who is aligned with whom, Armenia is aligned with Russia currently, right? And
well,
Iran?
There's some alignment. Armenia has a relationship with Russia, and Russia is supposed to help Armenia in times of crisis. And one of the few countries that has an open border with Armenia is Iran. But Armenia is very much on its own here. And this is why something I think that Alex will talk about is so important, is that they depend very heavily on the worldwide diaspora of Armenians for support. But Turkey now has sided, our NATO ally, Turkey, has sided with Azerbaijan in this conflict. And I think what's very concerning to me as a historian is, you know, Turkey, as the successor state of the Ottoman Empire, the Ottoman Empire sought 105 years ago to destroy the Armenian people of Anatolia in the second genocide of the 20th century. And they largely accomplished it. And the people who live in Armenia are almost all descendants of the small handful of survivors from that genocide. And right, and when they see what Turkey is doing and Azerbaijan is doing, they see this as a continuation of that genocide, or at least the potential for that, mm-hmm. as an existential threat. And all of the rhetoric coming out of Turkey right now and Azerbaijan is truly a hate-filled rhetoric that is painting a picture of the Armenians as the other who must be destroyed.
And that's spreading, is it not? We've seen violence in, I've read about some violence in San Francisco, and I imagine some other places as well.
Right. There were hate crimes against Armenian institutions in San Francisco over the last 3 weeks. And earlier last year, there was an attack on a school in Los Angeles. Thankfully, no one's been hurt. Only property has been destroyed. But this is what is at stake in this war. And so what we have to think about here is, are we prepared to tolerate this kind of violence? You know, we wouldn't tolerate a fire getting out of control in our, that's not what we do in California. We work to try to bring the fire under control. And I think that's really the problem here, is that the United States has been absent altogether from this. And there's a reason for that. I mean, Ken Rudin would explain this better than I.
Yeah, what is the United States position on this?
None. And the real problem there is this lack of leadership is the problem. We see congressional leaders right now seeking to end arms shipments or arms support to Azerbaijan. We also see growing calls on Israel to stop arms shipments to Azerbaijan. The United States, the NATO working with Turkey to stop the use of its military to support this effort. And then also, for example, Canada took a major step to essentially embargo very important technology to Azerbaijan that allows it to mount drone-based attacks on civilian targets in Armenia. Mm-hmm. So that's what's at stake. But yeah, the last time the Security Council met on this was last week. So I think it's COVID, the economic collapse, the lack of American leadership, and the fact that the region right now, Turkey, for example, is fighting a war on three fronts. Russia is concerned about what's happening in Ukraine, Belarus, Kyrgyzstan, and its own very weak and fragile regime that is becoming even more weak and fragile because of the decline in oil prices. We can go on, but this is what happens when there's not proper American leadership and a loss of our focus on promoting human rights, peace, and democracy abroad, right?
Professor, so this is a human rights issue in your view right now. Why? You're an expert on genocide. What defines a genocide?
A genocide, and the word genocide, I mean, there is an international law preventing genocide, the Genocide Convention, which was established in 1948. So it is against international law to commit genocide or to incite to genocide or to collaborate in genocide. And it's an attempt by a state to destroy and eradicate from the face of the earth an entire people. Mm. And we've seen this happen, and it's happening, it continues to happen, not just, it's not in our past, right? Rwanda, Bosnia, now what's happening in Burma and in Western China, that we see the genocidal process continuing without the international community raising its voice against it. So, we know from our own experience in this state that left uncontrolled or left unaddressed, these wildfires can just continue to grow and get out of control. And so that's one of my great concerns here. Mm-hmm. My other concern here is that if we are not perceived as protecting democracies and human rights upholding states around the world, what incentive do other states have to turn towards democracy, to uphold human rights? So I'm hoping that there will be an opportunity in, after the next several weeks or months, unfortunately, that there'll be a reassessment of international policy towards the South Caucasus, that pressure will be brought to bear, and that without it, without a, an international effort to bring a ceasefire and then to try seek to come to a just and equitable solution for all sides. Our, Azerbaijan has legitimate grievances here. Armenia has, and Nagorno-Karabakh have a right to exist, right? Turkey has no role, should have no role in this. So this is where diplomacy matters. Mm-hmm. This is where US leadership matters. And there is a great deal at stake, not just in this immediate conflict, but for the long-term role of the United States as the leader of the free world.
Keith David Wattenpaugh is professor and director of human rights studies at the University of California, Davis, and just gave us all a lesson on a very complex situation happening right now. Thank you so much for your expertise. It's very much appreciated by us here at Insight and everybody listening.
Thank you, Randall. Live long and prosper.
California is home to the largest Armenian American community in the United States. And if you've lived here long enough, chances are you may know someone of Armenian descent. And the war has hit the community hard. Joining us now to discuss the impact of this escalation in violence on California's Armenian American community is Alex Galitsky with the Armenian National Committee of America. And he's based in Los Angeles. Alex, great to have you here.
Thank you so much, Randall. Really appreciate your time.
Can you give us a sense of how big the Armenian community is here in California and sort of where it's centered and that sort of thing?
So by estimates, both through the U.S. Census and through other measures that we've been able to look through, the Armenian community of California numbers somewhere in the vicinity of about 1 million people. Mm. And in terms of where that is concentrated, we're looking at Glendale in Southern California, Los Angeles. Los Angeles County itself has at least 500,000 Armenian residents, meaning they make a huge proportion of the community there. And you could say that some people in our community could live their entire lives in Los Angeles and never be exposed to anything other than Armenian culture throughout right. their lives based on the institutions, whether that be the church, schools, organizations, youth groups. There really is this this effort and this huge institutional structure, organizational structure behind the mobilization of our community and the preservation of our cultural identity here in the diaspora of Southern California.
Armenian Americans have held protests up and down the state, including here in Sacramento. What is the message being sent and to whom is the message directed?
I think for our community, this is a sort of cathartic exercise because unfortunately what we've seen, and this is coming as a result of immense frustration at both the international community and international media in the failure to adequately cover this issue. So when we saw protests take place here in Southern California, Los Angeles, out front of the CNN building and the LA Times building last night, and in Sacramento, and then in San Francisco this Saturday, there are some protests planned as well on the Golden Gate Bridge at 11:30. And what we're seeing the asks from the community are, first of all, and I think Keith touched.
Oh, we just lost your audio briefly here. I'm going to try to pull that back in. This conflict is, you know, a half a world away. And I'm curious what some of the challenges are legislatively that your organization is working on so that you can, you know, have some sort of representation, I guess, to help battle that. Alex, are you with us?
Is the connection stable?
There we go. Yep, we got you back.
My apologies for that. Just to touch briefly on the previous question, the message, generally speaking, is we need to see better coverage from our media outlets and also from our leaders, both domestically here in the United States and internationally. Unfortunately, this issue has been presented through a sort of false equivalence of Armenia as a state seeking its right to self-determination and self-defense in the face of genocidal aggression, and Azerbaijan, which is clearly the perpetrator in this instance. And unfortunately, when language of neutrality such as both sides need to de-escalate and both sides need to sit at the table, it kind of establishes this idea that Armenia hasn't been trying to do that for the last 25 years. Unfortunately, Armenia has taken all the steps that it could possibly take to adhere to those processes of ceasefire and negotiation. Armenia has always been on the receiving end of Azerbaijan's hostility and aggression. So when there is a failure from the international community and the international media to identify Azerbaijan as an aggressor, it provides this veil of impunity that has, that we have seen at least over the last 25 years, the continued enabling of this perpetration of violence against our people. So what we want to see when it comes to international coverage, when it comes to the statements and comments from the international community, is a better effort when it comes to identifying and exposing aggressor states in order to ensure that this type of violence cannot be continued with impunity moving forward.
Alex, just briefly, the professor mentioned that Azerbaijan does have some legitimate grievances. What would those be?
I think Keith touched upon the points about the territory surrounding Artsakh, which is what we call the ancestral lands of Nagorno-Karabakh, that came under Armenian control through the Liberation War. And these territories are very much seen as a necessary buffer. If it weren't for some of these territories, there would be no contiguous geographic link between the Republic of Armenia and Artsakh, which would pose a major security threat to the Armenian people. There's also the issue of internally displaced people that unfortunately Azerbaijan has treated with immense disregard, placing them in temporary housing and refusing to restore full citizenship rights to many of these internally displaced people since the conclusion of the conflict. These are all things that are going to necessarily be a part of the negotiation and settlement process. Unfortunately, Azerbaijan has refused to sit down at that table. Azerbaijan has actually expelled the OSCE Minsk group, which is the predominant the organization that is mandated to oversee this. They've expelled the OSCE from actually operating in the South Caucasus by refusing to extend the mandate of their office in both Baku and Yerevan. So it's very hard when the organization that is meant to be there to resolve this issue isn't even allowed to operate with its offices in those countries or by providing ceasefire monitors on the front line. So a lot needs to be done in order to restore civility in the discussion here. And Armenia and Artsakh have always been prepared to do so.
We'll have to have you back on, Alex, to dig even deeper into this because it's something that just deserves a lot of time, right? Alex Galitsky with the Armenian National Committee, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
And still ahead, the book Driving While Black will become a documentary and will air on locally here on KVIE starting next week. We'll discuss that straight ahead. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. Next week on PBS, the documentary Driving While Black will premiere. It's based on a book by Gretchen Soren, which is the current selection for CAP Radio Reads. Reads host, Donna Apodoni, will interview Soren during a live online event this Friday and joins us now with a bit of a preview. Always great to speak with you, Donna.
Nice to be here, Randall. Thanks for inviting me.
Our current setup has a plexiglass between us and my back to you, which seems odd, but
that's okay. It works. Yeah.
I should also note that in just a moment, we'll be joined by Dr. Milman Harrison, who is a professor of African American studies at UC Davis, to help put the book's subject matter through a California lens for us. Donna, Gretchen Soren not only wrote the book, but she's also behind the documentary as well?
Yeah, she is. She's a distinguished professor. She has curated at museums up and down the East Coast, including the Smithsonian. She worked with Rick Burns, who is the brother of Ken Burns, a great family of documentary filmmakers, worked with him on another project, and then this came about. So the book came out in January, February, and now this fall, this month, we will get to see the PBS documentary. They are interactive in a lot of ways.
So the title of the book, Driving While Black, does it reflect what we've seen in the news in the past year, the racism people are protesting?
Well, that's the irony. You know, we've seen so much of people being taken out of their cars, being injured and shot and killed in their cars. And we think, wow, this is something that's going on in our country that's unfortunate. But this is a history book. It's a very dense history book in a lot of ways that Gretchen Soren has given us with Driving While Black. And it goes way, way back. It's transportation in all of its form a long time ago. It's made lighter with some family stories from Gretchen Soren and from some other people, including a family that grew up down the street from me in a different part of the country. We get to hear those family stories and it makes the book a little bit lighter. But there's some heavy and dark history that goes right back to the minute that slaves came into this country. I mean, we're talking about transportation that starts, the subtitle of the book is African American Travel and the Road to Civil Rights. So she starts with the slave ships. She explains how slaves had no opportunity to move off the property where they lived, and then the Underground Railroad and the Great Migration. Segregation on trains, harassment in towns. Cars were supposed to offer sanctuary. They were supposed to be freedom and safety, but that's the fallacy.
Mm-hmm. There were other problems, right?
Oh, big problems. Whites-only hotels and restaurants that people couldn't get into. So they ended up having to sleep in their cars. They ended up having to take large meals with them so they would never have to stop on their road trips. There were no restrooms available to a lot of people. And the beatings and the lynchings that we know existed in the North and the South were equal. I mean, there were bad times in all parts of the country.
So depending on your destination, the length of your travel and your route, where you might be passing through, your car needed to be reliable.
Absolutely. And big, too. Mm. You didn't want to break down. You didn't dare want to get caught in certain areas after dark. So a big, safe, sturdy car was important. Buicks were the most popular for a long period of time in the 50s, 40s, and 50s. They cost a year's wages for a lot of people. They were not a status symbol. They were a hotel for some. They were a built-in restaurant for some. And even with that supposed safety, there was still so much stress in driving any distance at all.
Yeah. And you mentioned the car being a hotel or a restaurant, but what about the ones that were accepting?
Well, the ones that were accepting came about a little bit later in a little bit different way. There were some white-owned businesses that sent such strong signals of racism through the messaging, even of their signs. There's a whole chapter about signs and the messages that they sent, including whites only, caricatures that were insulting in some way. This was not just in the East. In California, in Palo Alto, California, there was a 3-foot-high lettered sign that said KKK, 3-foot-high letters, bright red, at a major intersection just to let people know that they were not welcome in that area. But there were some other businesses owned by whites, owned by African Americans, that were far more welcoming to travelers, and they found out about those and felt much more comfortable staying in those places. The Jim Crow rules were different in different states. So interstate travel had its own share of difficulties in that regard.
Cap Radio Reads host Donna Appadoni. You do not want to miss her conversation. It's a live online interview with author, filmmaker Gretchen Soren this Friday. At what time Donna?
The interview begins at 6 o'clock Friday evening.
Those are great. I love watching the Cap Radio reads. Donna, thank you for sharing it with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Dr. Milman Harrison is an associate professor in the African American and African Studies Department at UC Davis, and he joins us now to continue the conversation. Welcome to Insight, Professor.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we appreciate it. So how does the book's topic help us better understand the contemporary African-American experience?
Well, I think it's really encouraging right now that there's such a swell of interest in the African-American story with respect to being able to move freely through this country. That's a freedom that we have never been able to take for granted to the same extent that others have. And that is an important, you know, the whole idea that you are not safe virtually anywhere you go in the country is or could potentially become territory. So yeah. It becomes very, very important that we were able to have those forms of information sharing to be able to move from one safe space to another and to avoid the sundown towns, for example, the places where we were explicitly unwelcome.
And when you hear the term white privilege, that's one of those layers that white people just don't think about. I'm going to get in the car, I'm going to go from here to another place, and it should be pretty much pain-free.
Absolutely. And the connection to today is very clear. And again, African Americans, we cannot necessarily take for granted that wherever we go, we will be welcomed. And so when we, especially in spaces that are privileged, we see stories. I read one this morning about an African American professor who was in the bathroom at her university and someone asked them to wipe down the counters, you know, not expecting that she was a professor, but they assumed that she or, you know, we've various stories of being kicked out, you know, having the police. Here's the other part of this that's very important. When, you know, the idea that any white person could walk up to you, ask to see your credentials, your key, your membership card, or whatever the case may be, to confirm you belong in this particular space.
Doctor, your phone is ringing because it's our producers. We want to get a better connection so people hear what you have to say.
Okay.
So I'll let you pick that up and let everyone know that we're speaking with Dr. Milman Harrison, an associate professor in the African American and African Studies Department at UC Davis. Doctor, I believe we have you via phone now. You can hear me? Oh, not yet. We don't have him yet. Dr. Milman is joining us because this coming Friday on Cap Radio Reads, our Cap Radio Reads host, Donna Appadoni, will be speaking with author and filmmaker Gretchen Soren. And do we have you back now, Doctor?
Hello?
Yep, we can hear you. Terrific.
Okay, great.
So the book, Driving While Black, how does the subject matter of that book relate to the Black experience in California?
I'm sorry, you, part of your sentence was cut out. I didn't catch.
Sure, yeah. The Black experience in California, how does the book and those two things come together?
This is a really good, good question. Because of California represents a certain type of space with respect to race. And it does, you know, there's this assumption that it was very, very different here in terms of Jim Crow and segregation. And as Isabel Wilkerson pointed out in her book about the Great Migration, Jim Crow in California was called James Crow, right? But what's important for people to understand is that in California, there were also sundown towns. By the way, James Lowen, who wrote the book about sundown towns, has tagged or on his website has over 120 towns in Sacramento. And Donna mentioned one, Palo Alto. Mm-hmm. But some of the towns that we wouldn't expect, all of Orange County, all of Humboldt County, Santa Ana, Pasadena, Anaheim, various places that we wouldn't expect today had that racist history. where, you know, so African-Americans may have had some degree of freedom in their own cars, but and as a colleague and myself, we've mapped these. I've mapped sundown towns, and you can see a straight line of, I used red flags. You can see a line that goes up Highway 99, for example.
Wow.
You can see them distributed from the top of the state to the bottom. These are places that, so if you imagine you are a migrant who's coming to California in your car, and you've made it through, you know, from wherever you were coming.
And you think you've made it to a safe place, but
California,
but not. And I can guarantee you, doctor, there are people that this is the first they're hearing of sundown towns. Dr. Milman Harrison, associate professor in the African-American and African Studies Department at UC Davis, thank you so much for joining us. We have to have you back.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
And that is Insight for today. Join us tomorrow for a debate recap.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.